Today is Thursday, July 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. Coming up, Britain's new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, outlined his priorities to Parliament.
And our mission is to deliver Brexit on the 31st of October.
Plus, North Korea launched two short-range projectiles as talks with Washington continue to stagnate.
And what's next for Washington after the special counsel has testified before Congress? Those stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition.
Former special counsel Robert Mueller told members of Congress Wednesday that his probe into Russian interference in the last presidential election did not exonerate U.S. President Donald Trump of allegedly trying to thwart the investigation. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler put that question directly to Mr. Mueller.
And your investigation actually found, quote, multiple acts by the president that were capable of exerting undue influence over law enforcement investigations, including the Russian interference and obstruction investigations. Is that correct?
Correct.
But how is the White House responding? Joining us on the phone with the latest reaction from the president is White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, welcome to the program.
Pleasure, Steve.
So what can you tell us about how the president has reacted to the testimony on Wednesday?
Well, the president was asked about this and replied extensively when he was on the South Lawn before boarding Marine One on Wednesday. And he was painting this all as a disaster for the Democrats and an exoneration of him. And skeptical reporters tried to follow up with questions to drill down on that and actually point out to the president that's not exactly what Robert Mueller was saying. And the president was very combative.
How was he combative?
Yeah, he called reporters fake news, said that they were being untruthful, and basically was turning it around on the journalists who were asking the questions about it.
Besides those responses, has the White House come out and said anything else in response to the line of questioning, both by Chairman Nadler, who put forward the question to Mr. Mueller, did it totally exonerate the president?
And no, the president himself was asked about that, and there's been nothing from the White House subsequent to that. Is quite typical here. They let the president speak for himself. When Trump was asked that Mueller specifically testified that he did not exonerate you, why do you continue to say that he does? The president replied, there's no such thing. He doesn't have the right to exonerate. He says people mention exoneration. That was something where he totally folded because he never had the right to exonerate. So that's the sort of line of response we've been getting from the president.
This is coming as we are entering into the 2020 election cycle. The Trump campaign, what has it said?
Well, it's pretty much of an echo chamber from what the president is saying. They came out with a statement to calling the hearings on Wednesday a disaster for the Democrat and saying that the Democrats have always been trying to undo the legitimate results of the 2016 election, and they failed miserably. And complaining about the waste of time and money, which is very similar to what the president has said, and says the Democrats are completely consumed with their hatred of the president and their obsession with overturning the will of the people who elected him.
Has the White House or the president given any indication what they plan to do next now that Mueller has completed his testimony?
Well, this is something they're going to campaign on. And the president is due to hold a rally in Cincinnati, Ohio, which could end up being a swing state. He'll be there next week. And you can expect to for the president to point to Mueller's testimony and the attempts by the Democrats in the eyes of many to have turned what happened on Wednesday into a de facto impeachment hearing into a patch of exoneration and a badge of honor.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
Officials say three bombs rocked the Afghan capital of Kabul on Thursday, killing at least 15 people as the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff was meeting top U.S. and NATO officials in the city. 8 employees of the Ministry of Mines and Petroleum were killed and 27 wounded in an attack on their bus, ministry officials said in a statement. 5 women and a child were among the dead. Minutes after the blast, a separate suicide bomber blew himself up a few meters away, killing at least 7 people and wounding 20. Abdul Sabur witnessed the blast and said a car bomb targeted the 2 vehicles of foreign citizens. It was a very terrible incident, the first he experienced. Islamic State claimed responsibility for 2 of the attacks, and the Taliban claimed responsibility for the 3rd. Another blast in Jalalabad, the capital of the Nangarhar province, killed 6 women and 3 children, all members of the same family, according to a government spokesman.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke to Parliament Thursday, where he vowed to take the country out of the European Union on October 31st.
For the purpose of uniting and re-energizing our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth.
For more details on Johnson's remarks and what it means for Britain, I spoke earlier with reporter Henry Ridgewell.
His speech today in Parliament signaled, a real about turn for the government in terms of its approach to Brexit. We have this looming deadline of October the 31st for when Britain is due to leave, and Boris Johnson again reiterated his absolute concrete commitment to leave by that date, with a deal or without a deal. And he's effectively given himself those limits, boxed himself in, which means Britain's options are now severely limited. Either Boris Johnson and his government must now go to Brussels and renegotiate a whole new settlement. He wants to bin the withdrawal agreement that his predecessor, Theresa May, spent 2 years negotiating with the EU and come up with new deals on, it looks like, individual elements of that withdrawal agreement, most notably over the Northern Irish and Republic of Ireland border, which has long been the key sticking point. So we have 98 days until that deadline. Boris Johnson says he can do it, that the EU, if they show flexibility, can do it as well. It's in everybody's economic interest. But it would be break all records to have some kind of withdrawal agreement, some kind of trade deal done in that short amount of time.
What was Parliament's reaction from the opposition party after Boris Johnson laid out this message?
The opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, spoke directly after Boris Johnson and accused him of being disingenuous on Brexit, of having actually voted for this Irish backstop clause when he was Foreign Secretary and when he was in government and on the back benches previously under Theresa May's government. And he warned that Boris Johnson's red lines made it much more likely that Britain would leave with no deal from the EU on the 31st of October. And he said that under those circumstances, Labour would campaign to remain within the European Union. The opposition, the main opposition, Labour Party, are treading this difficult line between not wanting to alienate their own supporters who voted for Brexit, but also trying to remain critical of a conservative Brexit policy. And you're seeing that really hit them at the ballot box as well. The polls show that the traditional political system in Britain is in a tailspin. We've got minor parties, parties that have only just started this year, like the Brexit Party, polling in the lead in some recent polls. The Liberal Democrats, who were on 8% not so many months ago, now up to 23%. They want to stop Brexit altogether. So the whole political process in the country is in a great state of flux. This appointment of Boris Johnson as the new Prime Minister has added a new layer to that. And I think there is an increasingly likelihood that there will be a general election in Britain.
Well, what would a general election do to the Brexit process?
Well, I think the EU, seeing that there would be a change to the democratic system in this country, they would probably allow an extension to the Brexit deadline, despite Boris Johnson's objections. And then it's anybody's guesses as to who might win that. Most polls suggest that no one party will get a majority. So we could just be back to square one, where all the parties, or whichever party is able to form a government, will have to rely on the support of others.
And that was reporter Henry Ridgewell from London.
Record temperatures are being set across Europe, including in Paris, as the continent swelters Thursday in what is its second heat wave of the summer. Climate scientists warn this could become the new normal in many parts of the world, but temperate Europe, where air conditioning is rare, isn't equipped for the temperatures frying the region this week. So tourists frolicked in fountains to seek relief, and authorities and volunteers fanned out to help the elderly, sick, and homeless who are hit hardest by the heat. Trains were canceled in Britain and France, and French authorities urged travelers to stay home. One by one, heat records are being broken across Europe. On Thursday afternoon, the Paris area hit 41.6 degrees Celsius, beating the previous high of 40.4 set in 1947. Authorities said the temperature was still rising as a result of hot, dry air coming from northern Africa that's trapped between two cold, stormy systems. The Netherlands and Belgium also reported new record high temperatures, and Britain is expected to do so later.
Here are some other major stories from around the globe. A U.S. federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from enforcing a directive that disqualifies a significant portion of mostly Central American asylum seekers who reach the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. President Donald Trump has vetoed a trio of congressional resolutions aimed at blocking his administration from selling billions of dollars in weapons and maintenance support to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And Elton John on Wednesday hosted a celebrity-packed gala that raised more than $6 million to fight HIV and AIDS in Kenya. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and with our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Among the top risk factors for heart disease is obesity. The most common method to determine obesity is by a person's body mass index or BMI score. A new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's JAMA Network Open suggests medical professionals not only look at a person's BMI score, but also body shape. Study authors found evidence that people with a normal BMI can still be at risk for cardiovascular disease, early death, and other obesity-related health issues if they also have an excess accumulation of fat around their midsection, something also referred to as central obesity. In other words, maintaining normal weight but having a large waist size could still spell health trouble. The study also suggests that some people, especially athletes, with a high BMI score can still be in excellent health because the bulk of their weight is muscle. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. I'm Dan Friedel. North Korea fired two missiles off its east coast Thursday. The launch comes as Pyongyang complains about upcoming joint military exercises between the U.S. and the South. Analysts say the launch probably will not derail nuclear talks, but it underscores the United States' inability to move those talks forward and may signal some frustration on the North Korean side. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
The missiles launched Thursday appear to be short range, possibly similar to those North Korea launched in May. That launch didn't derail nuclear talks. And Seoul-based analyst Bong Yong-shik says the latest one probably will not either.
It is another attempt by North Korean authorities to put additional pressure on Washington prior to actual negotiations to set the agenda for working-level negotiations on denuclearization.
But this launch comes at an especially tricky time, less than a month after U.S. President Donald Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the demilitarized zone, a meeting many White House officials described as a possible game changer. Since then, North Korea has failed to show up for working-level talks. Instead, Kim this week posed next to a submarine apparently capable of handling nuclear-tipped missiles. Another escalation, but Yong-shik says, mild by North Korean standards.
You do not want to anger President Trump. You want to keep him very close to your side. So I don't think North Koreans are ready to cross the red line.
Trump has shrugged off the North Korean provocations, instead stressing his friendship with Kim. South Korea has said it will go ahead with planned joint military exercises with the United States, despite North Korean objections. Washington and Seoul have already scaled back those exercises. But so far, that is not good enough for North Korea. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Thanks, Bill. U.S. naval warships sailed through the Taiwan Strait Thursday, a day after China issued a stark warning against any foreign interference in its attempt to reunify with self-ruled Taiwan. A spokesman for the Navy's 7th Fleet said the guided missile cruiser USS Antietam conducted a freedom of navigation exercise through the expansive waterway that separates the two rivals. Commander Clay Doss said the mission demonstrates the U.S. commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific. The U.S. conducted similar exercises through the Taiwan Strait twice in 2018. China's Defense Ministry issued a policy paper Wednesday vowing to go to war with anyone who interferes with its long-stated goal to reunify with Taiwan, which it considers a renegade province. The white paper also accused the United States of undermining global security and denounced Washington's arms sales to Taiwan. The United States has no formal diplomatic ties with Taiwan, but is bound by law to provide the island with sufficient military equipment to defend itself. This week in Poland, a conservative magazine distributed LGBT-free zone stickers with its most recent edition, amid a mounting backlash against gay rights in Central Europe's largest nation. Reuters reporter Emily Wither has that story.
A controversial sticker is making people from the LGBT community feel unwelcome in Poland. A conservative magazine has distributed LGBT-free zone stickers with its weekly edition this week. It comes amid a mounting backlash against gay rights in Central Europe's largest nation. The editor-in-chief of Gazeta Polska explained why he wanted to release them.
The campaign wasn't directed against anyone, against any individual. We want freedom of speech. This was the aim of this campaign.
He doesn't believe critical views should be censored, but it's making people from the community feel marginalized.
For sure it is an attack. The attack by that medium, which is supported by public funds and which shows they are second-class citizens. Of course, for years, LGBT people have been aware they are second-class citizens, because we are at the very end of the list of EU countries that have no regulation for the LGBT community.
The magazine is largely loyal to the government line and receives significantly more advertising placements from state-run companies. The nationalist Law and Justice government has faced accusations of fomenting anti-gay sentiment in recent months. They've made LGBT rights a central campaign issue, pitting the party against more liberal forces in the country. These stickers only upping the ante.
That was Reuters' Emily Wither.
On Wednesday, Sudan's military said it had thwarted a coup attempt and arrested an unspecified number of senior officers in connection with a plot to restore the party of ousted President Omar al-Bashir to power. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mohammed Othman al-Hussein, said the failed coup attempt's goal was to return the former National Congress regime to power and to disrupt the path before the expected political agreement to establish a civilian state that the Sudanese people dream of. The military said the coup attempt involved General Hashim Abdel Talib Ahmed, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a number of high-ranking officers from the armed forces and the National Intelligence and Security Service, and leaders of the National Congress Party and the Islamic Movement Party Bashir also headed. It was not clear when the attempted coup happened, but the military statement said it had been monitoring a failed coup attempt in the past weeks and was now uncovering its details. The ruling military council took over after the military ousted Bashir on April 11th, following weeks of street protests. New protests are being held today as pro-democracy activists demanded that the planned transitional government be dominated by experts, not members of political parties. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the largest survey of views on corruption in Africa reveals that more than 50% of citizens across 35 African countries believe corruption is getting worse. An in-depth look at corruption on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Science Edition of Press Conference USA celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, considered one of the greatest achievements in human history. NASA's chief historian William Barry joins host Rick Pantaleo to discuss how the space agency was able to meet President John F. Kennedy's challenge of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth before the end of the 1960s. Listen Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. After nearly 2 weeks of mass protests, Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosselló says he'll step down. Rosselló stirred anger in the U.S. territory after offensive chat messages between him and his top aides were leaked to the public. Reuters reporter Eve Johnson has more.
After 12 long days of protests, Puerto Rico is celebrating. On Wednesday, thousands flooded the streets of San Juan, cheering news that Governor Ricardo Rosselló is stepping down.
He should have resigned from the start, but we're super happy. The people can do it when they unite.
Rosselló made the announcement himself.
Today I feel that to continue in this position represents a difficulty for the success of the country. I made the decision after listening to demands, speaking to my family, thinking about my children, and praying.
The embattled governor had been caught up in a scandal of his own making after he exchanged sexist and homophobic chat messages with his top aides, messages that were later leaked to the public. On Sunday, Rosselló responded to critics with an apology and a promise that he would not seek re-election next year. He also gave up leadership of his political party, but it wasn't enough. The next day, 500,000 people turned out to demand his resignation, the largest demonstration yet. During his time in office, Rosselló has also been criticized for how he handled devastating hurricanes in 2017, back-to-back disasters which killed some 3,000 people. The storms hit just months after the island filed for bankruptcy. Rosselló has seen his options narrow in recent days. Earlier on Wednesday, a senior official in Rosselló's own party said the governor had a choice between resigning or facing impeachment. Rosselló will stay at his post until August 2nd, after which Secretary of Justice Wanda Vasquez is set to take over.
That was Reuters reporter Eve Johnson.
Tunisian President Bedji Kaid Essebsi has died at the age of 92. The Office of the Presidency said the veteran politician passed away Thursday after being taken to Tunis Military Hospital the night before. Essebsi was hospitalized in late June due to a severe illness. He was Tunisia's first democratically elected president and the heir to the country's founding father, Habib Bourguiba, who built up the country and educated its people. Essebsi came to power in 2014, 3 years after the Arab Spring uprising. Under the constitution, the interim president will be the president of the parliament, who will serve for up to 90 days. Parliamentary elections are expected to be held on October 6th, followed by a presidential election on November 17th.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, engineer Nelson Lopez, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Dan Friedel in Washington. And for Steve Miller, have a tremendous Thursday.